Let's start with the synthesis problems. So, first problem, you had a cyclic molecule with a side chain. Oh, and even before we get into this, let me describe the types of problems that you're going to expect for this quarter. So there's this type of synthesis problem where I give you some form of starting material, and you're allowed to use any kind of reagents that do not add carbons to the starting material. So in other words, whatever carbon framework you end up with, those carbons can only come from this as the source. So let me just show you the product in this case. So these are multi-step reactions. There may be 3, 4, 5 different steps, and so it's your job to figure out what the sequence of reagents would be and to show each of the intermediates that you would form as you use each one of those sets of reagents. That's a synthesis problem. When you're doing a synthesis problem, you show absolutely no mechanism, because that's just, you would never have time to finish anything. So it's just focusing on the transformation. There's then separately a mechanism problem, where you're given the starting material and you're shown a sequence of reagents. Sometimes if it's a longer reaction, maybe it's even just one reagent. Think of the hydroboration oxidation example. That's just one reaction, but a whole bunch of steps. So mechanism problem, a second type. Third type of problem that we'll do today is that if you have a set of substrates, reagents, and then you have a set of reactants, and then you have the products that are going to be formed. One of those three things I'll leave empty, and then you got to figure out what goes in that place. Wrong room, baby. So, fill in the blank problem, a rather infamous type of problem because they're very short, but you got to know your stuff because there's only usually one right answer. Another type or subset of problem will be short answer, which things like nomenclature, we're going to have a little bit of nomenclature this quarter. PKA values, I've already warned you about PKA values, correct? How many of you reviewed some of your PKA values over the weekend? How many of you have the answers to those oxygen 18 and alcohol exposure to a carboxylic acid questions that I'd given you along with the functional group with 3 oxygens attached to it, which I'd asked if anybody might be able to come up with that one. Did we do that already? Because I know I'm myself am behind, so it's very difficult for me to get up and say, don't fall behind if I've myself fallen behind. But yet, you are the ones being tested on the material. You do have a textbook. How many of you have recognized that we're actually in chapter 17 right now? So that means you haven't even opened up the textbook yet? And you do have a quiz Tuesday, and by the end of lecture today, it'll be very clear where we're headed for that quiz. So even though if you don't have the syllabus, you're going to be very firmly grounded in the textbook at least. So are you all going to fall behind right at the beginning? Because you don't have senioritis, but you have transferitis. I know that. You know, all your apps are already in for those of you who are transferring, and you're just trying to worry about your apartments and how you're going to get there and all that right now, right? Don't forget, you still got one more quarter of OCHEM to get through. And you don't want OCHEM to smack you on the way out of here, right? So, I knew I was going to lecture about that when I got to lecture, but getting out of my system now so we don't waste the time there. Don't fall behind, because as I warned you, the beginning of this quarter is going to be rough. We haven't even hit all the fun stuff yet. So, anyways. So the fourth type of problem, PKA value, short answer type problems, a little bit of nomenclature. Then the fifth type of problem will be theoretical, which that'll be a longer problem. And just in case you hadn't figured this out, the new students, there's no multiple choice exams in this class. Now, there is an optional exam that I'll talk about later in the quarter that some of you already know about, which is the American Chemical Society Standardized Exam in Organic Chemistry, which is an exam given across the country that voluntarily some institutions report those results back, not with names attached, just as a collective, so that there's established norms as far as what is expected based on this collection of institutions, what kind of performance could you expect out of an average organic chemistry class on these different types of questions? So it's a relatively good assessment tool that some of you might end up taking, because if you transfer from here to Berkeley, there's this really, crock of a system we have where OChem is classified as an upper division course, even though it's lower division everywhere else on the planet outside of the UC system, because it's a second year course. Now, part of the justification is at Berkeley, you have a chem majors OChem and you have a pre-med OChem, but that pre-med OChem is actually not that watered down. It's pretty comparable, in fact, to what we're doing here. So we automatically transfer to the 3 sequence at Berkeley from here, but the chemistry department there acknowledges there are some community colleges that do go a little bit more into OChem than others. So if you take the ACS exam and you score well enough, you get the Chem 112 credit, which is an upper division course. It also lets you have an idea of what should you learn from here. And I don't teach to the exam because I don't look at it from year to year. I have a sense of, oh yeah, there's the one or two things I seem to never get around to talking about that maybe at some point I'll say here's some things we didn't cover. There are study booklets out there now. There didn't used to be. But if you end up taking it, I don't report the scores to anybody. It's purely optional. But back to, I'm getting aside here today. The main point is, in this class, there's no multiple choice exams. So if you are an ESL student and you have a dedicated electronic translator, you're allowed to use those, but you can't use smartphones or anything like that because they're too smart. Easy just to take a whole bunch of lecture PDFs and put them on your phone. So having covered the different types of problems you're going to have, synthesis, mechanism, fill in the blank, short answer, and theoretical, let's solve this synthesis problem. So the big fat hint that was given for this problem was, what kind of functional group is it? What kind of functional group is it? Well, you've got two oxygens attached to the same position, so it's either ketal-acetal-hemi-ketal-hemi-acetal. We know it's not a hydrate because that would have to be two OH groups attached at that point. There is a hydrogen here as well, so that means it's either a hemi-acetal or an acetal. And the fact that both of the oxygens have R groups attached to it means it is an acetal, which under acid hydrolysis means that this is going to revert back to something that has a carbonyl, specifically an aldehyde. If we look at the carbon framework, there are 5 carbons exclusive of the other bit that's attached to the oxygen out here. And so if we take this compound and subject it to acid and water, then this ring is going to unfold. The position where the two oxygens attach, that becomes a carbonyl, which means it's an aldehyde. There are 5 carbons in that aldehyde. Plus, you do have an oxygen at the other end, which will not disconnect during opening. So it means you get, in the terminology that we learned in our lab lecture, a mega hydroxyaldehyde. Plus, there's this ethanol that's spit off, which we need that because if we look at the product, we can identify that there is a 5 carbon fragment that is functional in both ends, just like the hydroxyaldehyde. And then we have a 2-carbon fragment. Since there is a carbon-carbon bond that's formed between them, then what reaction seems the most obvious to try to perform in this case? A Grignard reaction. Because the only carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions we really discussed last quarter were the Grignard and the Wittig reactions. Wittig, though, makes a double bond instead of an alcohol. And given that that alcohol is in the middle of the molecule, we would have a very difficult time after a Wittig reaction selectively putting the hydroxy group at one position or the other. However, if we did the correct form of Grignard reaction, then the hydroxy group automatically ends up in the right place. But what's the big gotcha in this problem? We have an alcohol of the same molecule that has the carbonyl that we would want to attach. And if we look at that, we know that this is the carbonyl that needs to be attacked because of where the OH group ends up. The OH group always ends up where the carbonyl was. And I think in the other section, the hydroxy group was one more group over, which meant that this molecule was the Grignard reagent that you had to attack an oxidized molecule to form the right product. So they had the backwards problem. Here, we're going to make a Grignard reagent out of the more obvious molecule, the ethanol. And that means we're going to have to use a protecting group on this other one so that this alcohol does not just simply neutralize the Grignard reagent. So it was optional which protecting group that you could use because you had both DHP and a silochloride. I think most people did the silochloride, so I'll show that one. So TBDMS chloride is the one that I had recommended only because it's bulkier than simple trimethyl silochloride, less prone to hydrolysis. Separately, we need a halide out of that alcohol, so we could use PBr3, for example. Then react it with magnesium and diethyl ether in order to make the Grignard reagent. Combine the two together, which you have to be careful how you notate this next part, because after the reaction, we need to protonate the alkoxide that's formed. If I put H plus at the arrow I've just written, though, that means that the H plus is reacted at the same time as both of these reagents, which, of course, that would just kill off the Grignard reagent. So if you're taking a shortcut, you need to do something like this, where you show protonation as a separate step. But once you do protonate, if you use a strong enough acid, you can both knock off the protecting group and protonate the alcohol that just got formed by the Grignard reaction. Anyone have any questions about this problem? Now, of course, at the end here, if you'd used dilute acid, you would have been able to retain the protecting group, and then you could have followed that up with TBAF, tetrabutyl ammonium fluoride, which some of you took that approach. Or if you used DHP and made the tetrahydropyranyl ether, then again at the end, if you use acid and water in that case, then you would have protonated the alkoxide and knocked off the THP group. So I move on to the next problem. Ah, yes. In this one you had an alkene. Which is reminiscent of the structure we find in a set of compounds known as terpenes, something that we'll be getting to at the end of the quarter. Terpenes have this five-carbon framework, which if you were really creative, imagine if you could imagine a little stick figure with two legs, in this case he'd be flying, I guess, and then the head at the other end. Well, depending on how different isoprene units, which this is not the exact same thing, but how these five carbon units align with each other, either head to tail, head to head, or in a cycle, they produce things like all kinds of molecules. Simple things such as menthol that you'd find in mints, lavandulol, all these different derivatives from plants, fragrances, all the way up to big, huge molecules like cholesterol. So we're going to investigate that class of compounds. I'm just mentioning this for the people that are more of a bio bent. We do get to get our feet wet with a little biochemistry later in the quarter. So back to synthesis, though, we have this five-carbon fragment that is somehow is mixed with this aldehyde to form a ketone, but one that is deuterated. And I see, there's a note here, says, where did a carbon-carbon bond form and how? Well, that gets at the approach that I would normally recommend that you take for synthesis problems. So for the newbies, what I normally do is what I did do up above, which is try to circle where the carbon framework of each reactant shows up in the product. If we look at the structure of the reactant, we have a 5-carbon fragment that's got that split in it, and we can find the same 5-carbon fragment in the product. Of course, the only thing left over is a 2-carbon fragment, which we've got here. We see that there's a new carbon-carbon bond, and we originally started with an alkene, which was functional at 2 positions, and you can see that we end up with something that's functional at 2 positions. In one case, we end up with a ketone, and the other, it's that new carbon-carbon bond. But notice that where the carbon-carbon bond forms is not where the oxygen is. If we did a Grignard reaction, the oxygen of that product ends up where the carbonyl had been. But it's not here. But there was one other functional group that we talked about last quarter that I made sure to show examples of reacting with Grignard reagents. And what was that other functional group? An epoxide. Because an epoxide, if you attack it with a really basic reagent, then due to sterics, it attacks at the less substituted position, pushes the ring open, and you end up with the oxygen 1 carbon away. Exactly like what we've got here. So we've got 2 issues. One, we need an epoxide, which there's a 1-step way and a 2-step way to get that from the alkene. Second, though, there's this deuterium, which threw a lot of people off. But you might remember that at some point in the quarter, I showed you these 2 reactions. That if we had a regular aldehyde that we reduced with a regular reducing agent, we would make technically an alkoxide first, which then if you threw deuterated acid at it, you can end up with a deuterated alcohol, where the deuterium itself is on the oxygen. But we also saw that we could flip the sequence of hydrogen versus deuterium being introduced to the molecule. In other words, if we use sodium borodeuteride, then the deuterium ends up attached to the carbon instead. Then if we just acidify normally, we end up with a regular alcohol, but then on the carbon has been substituted with a deuterium. That's exactly what we need in this problem, because we need a Grignard reagent, and we need the Grignard reagent to react at the same position where the deuterium is at. We have an alcohol at that correct position, 2 steps away then from being that Grignard reagent. So, again, react it with PBr3, thionyl chloride, something to make a halide. And then magnesium and ether to make the Grignard reagent. Separately, we take the alkene, and we can do 1 of 2 things. We could react it with MCPBA, metachloroperoxybenzoic acid, or MMPP, magnesium monoperoxyphthalate. Those 2 different reagents that in different textbooks show up most commonly. They're peroxy acids. And in a concerted mechanism make the epoxide. But remember, there's also this trick that we could do where we could make the halohydrin first. Use bromine and water. To make a halohydrin, which upon treatment with sodium hydride does an intramolecular SN2 and gets us the epoxide as well. So that epoxide, we then react with the Grignard reagent. We end up with the alkoxide on the inside of where the attack occurred. We've made the new carbon-carbon bond. We have the deuterium in the right place. We treat it with acid to get the alcohol out, and then any form of oxidizing agent we use would bring that to the ketone. Secondary alcohols can't be oxidized to carboxylic acid, so it doesn't matter if we use chromium trioxide or PCC. Questions about that synthesis problem? Then let's skip over mechanism just for the moment, and let's do the back page problems, the fill in the blank problems now. So first problem, you had an epoxide that reacted with something to form a molecule that had both an alcohol and an ether. So this problem gets at the two ways that we learned that epoxides can open, one under cationic conditions, one under anionic conditions. Under cationic conditions, the attack occurs at the more substituted position because of the greater ability to form a potential positive charge. But under basic conditions, attack would occur at the less substituted position because of sterics. Now look at where the OH group ends up. It ends up at the less substituted position, which means the attack occurred at the more substituted position. You also notice that stereochemistry is inverted at that more substituted position, which is exactly what you would expect in cationic ring opening. Since it's cationic, that means that you must use an alcohol with an acid catalyst. If you said sodium methoxide followed by H+, no, because that would cause attack at the less substituted position. If you had H+ and sodium methoxide together without a 1 and a 2, it's technically correct, but it's still wrong in a sense because the methoxide would react with the H+ to make the methanol, which then, though, would do the correct reaction. Now, if you do, again, section 1 and 2, you do have a different problem set. So the ether and alcohol were switched on your final, meaning that you would have used basic conditions, anionic mechanism. The next one. We have a ketone, but we also have a ketal. Two oxygens, each with an R group, both attached to the same carbon that has no hydrogen. So ketal reacts with first a Grignard reagent, followed by water, acid, and heat. Now, I did have a caveat in here that said that the product must be isolatable. To kind of jump straight to the point, yes, you have a ketone. Yes, a ketone, in theory, could make a hydrate under acid and water conditions. But it's not isolatable, not in most cases. So if you carried the reaction too far, all the way to the hydrate, then it was considered incorrect. But was the point of this problem? To recognize that the ketal doesn't react, that it's a protecting group for the ketone it could turn into. But we do have an exposed ketone that will react. So you get one substitution, and then when you hydrate the molecule, you'll break open the protecting group, getting a ketone, and so the product would be this. Or, because of the acid and heat, as we're seeing this quarter, you could dehydrate. Now I'm just going to keep rolling through these problems because I want to make sure you have the same lab time as the other section did. So stop me if you have a question about any one of these problems. Next one. We had something reacting with a Wittig reagent. A single carbon Wittig reagent. So the product did have both an alkene and an alcohol, but the alcohol was really just to throw you off the track. Because all that really matters is, how did the alkene form? Break it apart, one side of it only has that one carbon that would have come from reaction with the Wittig reagent. What must have been there instead was a carbonyl. So the answer in this case looked the same, except with an addition of the oxygen at the end of the double bond. Next reaction, the simplest, or one of the simplest, a chiral alcohol reacting with something to make a chiral chloride with opposite stereochemistry. Well, the only answer for that was thionyl chloride. Now, I'm still trying to find out a good reason. I'm determined to find one soon because the question has come up again as to why tosyl chloride cannot do this reaction. Remember that tosyl chloride will make a tosylate. But yes, there is a chloride kicked out in that process that for whatever reason, and that's the one I got to go figure out, it does not come back to attack the tosylate that was just formed. Whatever conditions are used for thionyl chloride, though, causes the additional attack of chloride that gets us this inversion, that gets us the chloride. So only thionyl chloride acceptable for this answer. Now, next problem. Oops. I don't know if somehow you knew this problem was coming or you all just got good at handling cyclic compounds, maybe a little bit of both. But I was surprised how many people got this one right. Yes, question. Oh, okay. Because what kind of functional group is this? Don't forget all our I and A functional groups. We had amine, imine, and enamine last quarter, correct? And then so far we have amide and imide this quarter. So make sure to keep all those very closely named functional groups separate in your head. This is an imine, which means we have a carbon-nitrogen double bond, which upon hydration, which that's secretly what this is, you get back a ketone or aldehyde. Since there's no hydrogen on that double bond, that means it is going to be a ketone. Since it's deuterated acid and water that's being used, when you open the product up, aside from the carbonyl, you also have an amine. One, two, three. But that amine, because of the reagents used, will have deuterium on it. So that was the blank on that problem. Next problem starts with unknown substrate reacting with a 3-carbon Grignard reagent, which just to be different, I threw in an alkyl iodide or magnesium iodide. Now, this is a little bit different than a standard Grignard reaction because instead of doing protonation afterwards, you react it with an alkyl halide, which, think of it this way. If you had a Grignard reaction that you didn't quench, then you'd have an alkoxide, which is a nucleophile in SN2 reactions. This is the excellent substrate for SN2 reactions. So if you look at the product, the methyl group ends up on the oxygen. To analyze the problem further, then, we look at the Grignard reagent used, and it had 3 carbons in it, only 3 carbons. So there's the only 3-carbon fragment that would not include the carbonyl. So pull both of those alkyl groups off reformed the carbonyl, and that meant the starting material had to be butane-2-one. Four carbon compound with the carbonyl on the second of the carbons. Now just a couple more problems, then a few notes about lab, and then we'll get going on lab. Oh boy, do I hope you all remember the name of this. Anisole. Anisaldehyde that you're using in today's lab, that only differs from this by the fact there's a carbonyl there. Since para-anisaldehyde, you're going to smell like it all day long after today's lab, unfortunately. And since you've been pointed out that this name is anisole, one might wonder if one might be asked for the structure of para-anisaldehyde only being provided the name, let's say on a lab exam or something like that. It means know the darn structure for para-anisaldehyde. This reacts with something to make an acylated anisole. Well, we only learned one acylation reaction, which was Friedel-Crafts acylation, which requires an acyl halide that we know how to synthesize now. So doesn't that open up some interesting synthetic possibilities? So an acyl halide plus a Lewis acid, most common of which being aluminum trichloride. Final problem, something reacts with an excess of PCC, which the only reason I put excess there was to see if you were brain frazzled at that point, because I was wondering if you might read water by mistake. But this doesn't mention water, just says excess PCC in pyridine to make this hydroxyoxoaldehyde. Actually, it wasn't excess. I'm sorry. Got to look at the fine print. It was two equivalents. Two equivalents means for every molecule that you started with, two equivalents were consumed. Now, in retrospect, I should have been fussier about the way I graded this, because the only way that two equivalents must have been used is if two things got oxidized. We have two carbonyls, so that means the starting material would have had to have been a triol. Has recognized that tertiary alcohol would not have been affected by an oxidizing agent and was not formed by an oxidizing agent. So the answer I was expecting was this. The aldehyde came from a primary alcohol, the ketone came from a secondary alcohol, and of course there's the tertiary alcohol that had not reacted in the first place. If one or the other carbonyls you had present in your starting material, I think I ended up counting it, because I think I ignored the two equivalents part. Now, some other day, when we got some more time, maybe we'll cover some of the other answers, but at least this was a small review of synthesis, you could say. So now just a few brief notes about the lab we're going to do, because I know we did the lab lecture for this last week, so just some reminders. The one main hazardous reagent that you've got today is the concentrated sodium hydroxide. However, as I commented a moment ago, it is likely that if you get the para-anisaldehyde all over you, that you're going to carry this sort of sickly sweet odor with you the rest of the day. So whenever you do get home, I recommend that you wash up just to get the smell out of you. As far as waste disposal, I don't think you're using anything acidic today, are you? So the only waste streams you're likely to generate, therefore, are organic, which is back in H5, and then the base waste, which is located up here. Please, 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 we're starting a fresh quarter in lab. If you get to a waste bottle that's almost full, we're not supposed to let the waste bottles get full. So please, we can just grab new waste bottles, but to make sure that everything's being labeled properly, come interrupt me and make me go slap a label on it right at that moment. just because I've noticed in the past there have been times where at the end of lab that I'll go back and label something, which since I'm watching, I know what it is, but we really should be doing it ahead of time. We're going to do half quantity for this lab. So I'd recommend that you leave a space, a blank area over next to your quantities to make changes. We are going to be doing this in half quantity, anticipating the question. 5 drops make it 3. You know, 5 divided by 2 is 2.5, but err on the side of excess hydroxide. So err on 3 drops side. Your product is a solid. You're not doing any washes. You're just doing vacuum filtration, which yesterday the vacuum system was working, yes. So hopefully we won't be going through that every time this quarter. Because you're just doing the vacuum filtration, and because we were behind, we're starting this a day late, I don't want you to do recrystallization this time. That's also because there were so many times last quarter where you got a product, it was obvious, and you lost it in the process of doing recrystallization. Since you've struggled enough with recrystallization, let's just focus on making some product. We already reviewed last time anyways about why it's only one product that should likely form during this reaction anyways. It's an ideal mixed aldol condensation. Did I stress enough times last time the possibility that the concept of an ideal mixed aldol would be perfect material for a lab quiz? Well, if I didn't, I just did it right then, didn't I? Let's see, what other notes? So the only characterization we're going to do for this lab is IR, because even if we're going to do NMR, this isn't the best substrate for us to do it on. So only IR analysis. But I recommend that unless you do finish really quickly and you've got time to dry your product out, that you leave the IR analysis till next time, because a wet product is just automatically going to give you an alcohol peak that you don't want to have, especially if we're trying to confirm that we did go all the way through dehydration to make that unsaturated ketone product. So you could put it in the oven for a few minutes. If you do end up just storing it, though, to let it air dry, because it's a solid, it does not need to be contained and sealed off like a liquid would. But you do need to label it. So you need to put your name, the date, and then the name of the compound, which that name of the compound should be in the textbook somewhere. And then I recommend just putting that on a watch glass. And for the new people, you just store things in your same locker as your glassware. Of course, you want to be a little careful the way that you place it in there so it doesn't tip out or something next time that you open up your drawer. Any questions about procedure? Yes. Yes. But question? Are we going to do more NMR problems? Yes, but I want to start that maybe next lab lecture, maybe a little bit later in the quarter. Get us through these first few labs and all the heavy synthesis first. But yeah, we got to worry about NMR again. So at some point, because the lab quizzes from last quarter, the end of the quarter lab quizzes, all three sections had different problems. So we got 6 problems that we can review for practice. So we will do that first before we do new things. Any other questions? Then let's go ahead and get to work.